fair chunk of the talk into talking sort of more generally about what probability itself means. Because probability is a pretty obscure concept. Now, there's a reasonable thing you might have to say there, which is something like, we're just trying to understand the physical theory. Do we have to go off and look at these quite conceptual, quite philosophical questions about what probability is? And in a sense, the answer is no, you don't. There's an alternative. You can just say, OK, I'm not sure what probability is, but whatever it is, the quantum amplitude squared is probability. Now, if you think that's not a good idea, then presumably you think it's not a good idea because of something about the concept of probability. And so if you don't like that way of doing it, it is necessary to look at what probability is. But you know, in a sense, if you're relaxed about probability being a primitive concept and it doesn't need analysis, then you can be just as relaxed in the other interpretations you can from theory. I don't think we should be so relaxed, and I'm going to spend a while trying to say how I think it can understand probability. So what is probability? There's a classic sort of standard answer, sort of thing if you look at any undergraduate textbook you'll probably get. Probability is something like long-run frequency. It's something like to say that an atom has probability 0.6 of decaying over a given hour, it's something like if you take a million atoms, you watch them for that hour, then you'll find 0.6 times a million of them decay. Okay, but there are very serious problems with that. Okay, firstly, this is something defined in the long run as the number of experiments goes to infinity. Now, in practice, what happens as the number of experiments go to infinity is your budget gets cut, or the sum explains. We never see the long run. In the long run, we're all dead. So there's a question about whether the concept is properly separately defined. And there's also the point that, even ignoring that, we use probability talk to consider even single events. So I've got two atoms. One of them's uranium-235, and it's got a half-life of about 10 to 10 years. One of them's, let's say one of them's a neutron, that's got a half-life of about 10 minutes, according to standard theory. So you're going to make exactly one quantum measurement. You're going to measure whether one of these things decays over the next 5 minutes, and then after that you're going to retire from theoretical physics and become a merchant banker. And there's $1 million riding on the result. So you're not going to measure an infinite long sequence of these things, you're going to measure one. Which one do you measure? You measure the neutron. Why? Because the neutron's probability of decaying over 10 minutes is way higher than the uranium atoms. What does that mean? If probability is frequency, it gives this. And most seriously with the frequency approach, there's a circularity. Because what's the result we're appealing to? We're going to say, in the long run, the frequency is convergent with probabilities. But by what measure? Obviously, if you run the experiment 10 times, it's possible that, say you say it's just a toss coin or something. I toss the coin 10 times, it's possible that I get 10 heads. I toss it a million times, it's possible that I get a million heads. No matter how often I toss it, it's possible I'll always get heads. But it's very, very unlikely that I'll always get heads. And so you can see this in the sort of formal mathematics where you consider how the frequency is convergent with probabilities. The measure is itself a probability. So when we say, in the long run, the frequency is convergent with probabilities, what we're actually saying is, in the long run, probably the frequency is convergent with probabilities. So if we want that to be a definition of probability, we've got a problem. And incidentally, if you don't think that's a problem, then again, you shouldn't have a problem with the Everett interpretation. Because the Everett interpretation is trying to say the weights become the frequency, the weights are equal to the frequencies. And it can't say that. All it can say is the weights are equivalent to the frequencies with high weight, which is exactly the same as circularity. So we can see that the problem with the simplistic frequency approach to the Everett interpretation is, in many ways, not a problem unique to the Everett interpretation. It's just the rephrasing in Everett terms of a problem that was there all the way along. I think this is stuff you see quite often in the Everett interpretation. Sometimes something that looks as if it's a new problem the Everett interpretation brought up is actually a problem we've had all the way along to the Everett interpretation that sort of brought into sharp relief. So I was talking quite a lot Tuesday, about how higher level structures emerge from lower level structures. And that's a problem which we're sort of forced to confront. It's flung at us for the Everett interpretation. But the answer wasn't in any way specific to the Everett interpretation. It was a general story about higher and lower level structures. So same here, that there is a problem with the frequency definition of probability in the Everett interpretation. It's basically just the many worlds version of a problem that's there all the way along. But just because it's a problem for everyone doesn't mean it's not a problem. So we've still got the question, how do we understand probability? If it's not long-run frequency, what the hell is it? As a reasonably good lesson generally, if you're trying to work out what something means, have a look at how it's used. The use of the term doesn't necessarily exhaust what it means, often gives you a good handle of what it means. So let's look at how we use probability, the probability concept, the word probability, in life insight. Okay, claim, there are basically two important ways in which we do it. Probability turns up in inference and it turns up in decision. It turns up in inference. If you make a whole load of runs of an experiment, and during that experiment you get let's say you're measuring spin or something, and that's not a good idea, it's a quantum example. Say that you're tossing a coin, you think it's biased. And you toss the coin a million times, and 43% of the time you get heads. Then you sort of feel justified in concluding that the probability of the coin landing heads on an individual toss is 43%, or something very close to 43%. And if you only toss the coin 5 or 6 times, then your guess as to what the probability is more approximate, it's more tentative, but nonetheless you'll make a guess. Secondly, it comes up in decision making. If you know something's really probable, you're better. Even if you don't know it's certain, you don't know this thing is going to happen, but you know it's probably going to happen. What does that mean? We're not sure. But one of the ways it enters into our life is that if something's probably going to happen, we'll bet on it. We'll act on the assumption it's probably going to happen. If it's very probably going to happen, we'll sort of ignore for practical purposes the possibility it won't happen, even though we're not saying we know. Similarly, if we know doing this thing, which we're sort of considering doing, will make that thing happen, which is quite probably, and if that thing's really bad, we won't do this thing. If we've got some device where I press this button, I get a chocolate bar, and I'm told there's a 20% probability that we're going to destroy the universe, then I don't press the button. Okay, now there's a quite popular approach to understanding probability, popular among some chunks of philosophy and recently popular among some quantum information theorists, basically that's all there is to probability. Probability is simply a way of understanding the ways in which we act and form beliefs about things. So there's one possibility. Is that all there is to probability? No, it's not. But before I say why I think that's true, I want to cash out that how that sort of story would go, because although I don't think it's all of probability, it gives you an important handle on some of probability. So that sort of approach to probability is sometimes called subjectivism, which is basically saying probability is just some sort of measure of our beliefs. Loosely speaking, you might want to say something like, to say that I have a high probability of something, loosely and intuitively means something like I believe it more than I believe this other thing, which has a low probability. More concretely, you can make sense of what a probability is by looking at how somebody acts, and particularly you can look at how somebody bets, how somebody makes decisions in the face of uncertainty. So a bet might be something really literal, like betting on the races. It might be something that's only figuratively a bet, like do I cross the road? What I want to do is get across the road. If there's not a car coming, if there's not some joyrider speeding down the road at 100 miles an hour, then I'll get to the side of the road. If there is a joyrider coming down the road, I'm going to get squashed flat. I don't know which of those things is true. I choose to cross the road. What's that expressing? It's expressing somehow that my belief in the joy rider coming is very small, but I don't believe it's true in life. That sort of qualitative account occurs. And the branch of, I don't know what you call it, philosophy, applied psychology, game theory, that handles that quantitatively is called decision theory. And here's how it works. Stylized model of a decision problem. I've got some set of states, and the states are supposed to be ways the world could turn out, results of a toss of a coin, or of a measurement, or of an election, or of a war, or of a horse race. And I've got some set R of rewards, things we want or we don't, or things we care about. Maybe they include being alive, or hot sex, or winning the lottery, or getting somebody to do this apparently very difficult assignment for you, or whatever you like. It could just contain prizes and dollars. And then a bet, it, formally speaking, is just a function from the states to the rewards, which basically says, if this state happens, I get this reward, if that state happens, I get that reward. Here's a very simple model, this is out of date now, I guess, but say it's a year ago, and there are two possible states here, Bush wins the election and Kerry wins the election, which is not thought about other candidates, I think we missed it. And the bet, then, is just a function from that states to the rewards, which are in dollars. So suppose that B of Bush winning is $10, B of Kerry winning is minus $10, formally, mathematically, that's a function from the states of the act. Clearly, what it's representing informally is just betting $10 each way on the draft election. So, what's the point of that? Well, here's the idea. You've got this whole range of possible bets. Clearly, the number of bets is all the possible functions from the states of the act. So, it's a very large set. And you want to consider that you've got some agent, and this guy has got a strategy. He doesn't know what bet he's going to get offered. He knows that somebody's going to offer him some bets. He might have more than one bet to choose, and he doesn't know which ones. But in advance, he's sort of trying to work it out. What am I going to do if I'm offered some of these bets? Which one do I like most? So what that translates to is he's going to put all the bets in order. He doesn't know which bets he's going to be offered, but if he's offered some of these bets, he's going to choose the one that's first in his ordering. If none of them are ones he likes very much, well, that's too bad. He'll just choose the one he dislikes least. Either way, it's represented just by an ordering of events, which I'm representing just by the numerical order of Friedstein. So for every pair of pets, B1, B2, he's in one of three states. Either he prefers B1 to B2. If he's offered B1, B2, he'll take B1. Or it's the other way around. He'll take B2, or he doesn't give a damn. He doesn't know, he doesn't mind which one he takes. Now, obviously, there are an awful lot of ways to find such an order. But now we want to suppose this guy is obeying, his strategy obeys some sort of intuitive principles of rationality. He's not going to do something that everyone would agree is completely inherent. So, for instance, he's not going to say, I prefer the first bet to the second bet, I prefer the second bet to the third bet, but I prefer the third bet to the first bet. Doesn't really make sense. And similarly, suppose that he's got two bets available, and one of them always gives him more money. Doesn't matter what the outcome is, one of the bets gives more money than the other one. Then he's always going to go for the first one. So, you know, maybe I'm going to bet, either I get $10 if Bush wins and lose $10 if Kelly wins, or I get $20 if Bush wins and get the nothing if Kelly wins. Which one do I do? I do the second one. Doesn't matter how likely Kelly or Bush is to win, all I need to know is that whichever one happens, I get one. So it's principles like that. I'm not going to give a full list of these principles. There's a little toy list in some of the reading, and there's a reference there for the sort of classic source of what a full list of those would be. But the point of all is, this is all a qualitative game so far. We're just looking at, do I prefer this thing or that thing? No numbers are coming in at all, no probabilities in particular. But the thing is that we can get it. Because if we set up decision theory right, and we choose a sufficiently full set of axioms like that, we can prove what's called a representation theory. So, a representation theorem would say something like this. I've got some strategy, doesn't matter which strategy, except that it's got to obey these rationality principles. And then, if that's true, then there exist two things. There exists a positive value function, pra, on the set of states, such that if you sum the pra of every state, you get one. And the function u, which is usually called utility, on the space of rewards, which isn't unique, but it's unique up to this fairly boring transformation. And the way these are found is that they are such that this thing holds, that I prefer the first bet to the second bet, if and only if this particular weighted sum of the utility is greater for the first bet than the second bet, where the weighting is this function pro. And you can see that intuitively, this thing pro is playing the role of a probability. We're basically saying, what's our expected payoff? We haven't brought in at the start any of this mathematical structure of probability and utility. We've inferred it. We're saying, if you are somebody whose preferences can't be represented by some choice of probabilities and some choice of utilities, then you are irrational. You're breaking one of these intuitive rationality rules. If you're somebody whose preferences are represented by two different probability measures, you're also irrational. You're breaking some rules somewhere. And there's an assignment which I'll give to Joseph for later, which just takes you through a simple model of one of these decision theories to show you how that works in practice. All right. So, suppose that works. We've shown a rational agent must act as if to every event he's assigned a probability. So the claim, maybe it's true that that's all we need to do. That it's not just as if, that's what probability means. It's the things that turn up in this quantification of an agent's betting preferences. Is that true? Is it terrible? Why? Because these probabilities are individual. It makes sense for me to say, what's my probability of this winning? Example now, what's my probability of Tony Blair winning the next British election? It makes sense to say what's Adrian Kent's probability of winning the next election, but it doesn't make sense to say what's the probability of Blair winning the next election. Now maybe that's plausible for elections or something, where maybe it's just a matter of opinion. But we want to say if this is all probability is, we're going to have to say the same about a neutron or something. So I've got a neutron in a box, and I watch it for the next 5 minutes, and we want to say we mean by my probability of a neutron decay, we can say what we mean by Joseph's probability of a neutron decay, but we can't say what it means to say, means to talk about the probability of a neutron decay. And that's what it is. If it's one lesson from 100 years of probabilistic concepts coming up in physics, it's that these probabilities are objective, they're out there. When we measured the half-life of uranium, it wasn't a sort of consensus among people that they all had similar belief. It was a fact about reality. If somebody comes along and says, I think the half-life of uranium is 25 seconds, that guy is not somebody who just happens to have a different set of beliefs and preferences than me. Not just some guy who objected to me. That guy is wrong. And our notion of probability has got to retain that robustness, that objectivity. Otherwise, it makes a nonsense of 20th century physics. Sure. This one is better, guys, Mike, I think. This one, I think. Yeah. Hang on. I don't know if it's turned it off, actually. I'm not sure. Hang on, I'll put this way. Right, yeah. Yeah, ridiculous. Okay, so that's the... Oh, sorry, that is ridiculous. Exactly that, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But also, to the point that you made, that, you know, can't we say, like, you know, if you're using the same data, so, by using the same sets of data, you should derive the same conclusions. So it's not really, I mean, it's the probability is it's kind of defined on a set of data as your own some references.
They have the same
methods.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
this
is worth it. Okay, so it's worth responding to that. Okay, so you could say, well, look, two different agents, they confront the same data, they'll apply the same strategy in similar cases to come to the same answers. And so maybe there isn't an objective probability, there's some sort of surrogate. Okay, and I think there are two problems with that. One of them is conceptual. It still seems that when people are discovering and calculating cross-sections in quantum mechanics, it still seems you're discovering a fact about the world rather than just observing an intersubjective agreement. But there's also a technical problem with it, which is that it's not literally true as stated. Suppose you and I both come and we're trying to work out whether this thing is going to decay quick or slow or something. And we're confronted the same big set of experiment data, but I start off with a very, very high prior probability of thinking it's quick, and you start off with a very, very low probability that it's quick. But even though we see this massive chunk of data, it might well be that our beliefs afterwards are still very, very different. And you can prove two results that go against each other. You can prove, firstly, no matter how different our opinions are, there will always be some amount of data, so it will be in agreement. But conversely, you can always prove, no matter how much data there is, we can always have some original set of opinions that are sufficiently different, or we won't be in agreement. And because the initial set of agreeing of opinions here is supposed to be sort of pure opinion and not constrained by the world, then there's no real way of saying why any starting preference can be rational or irrational. So that's the problem with that question. Okay. So what are we to do in this situation? We've got a paradox, or we've got a clash. We've got two different notions here. We have subjective probability. It's well-defined, it's well-motivated, it measures our personal degrees of belief. We have a lovely piece of mathematics that explains why our qualitative preferences and beliefs get quantified in this particular mathematical way. But whatever that probability is claimed, it can't be the probability of the physics difference. And we've got this second thing, this objective probability, if you like. It's the observer-independent probability of the physics calculus. It's the thing you measure when you measure the half-life of the neutron, half-life electron, as far as I know. It's the quantity you calculate in scattered cross-sections. But what on earth is it? And a partial way of answering this comes from a principle that philosopher David Lewis called the principal principle on the grounds that it was supposed to capture the most important facts about the relationship between these concepts. And Lewis wants to say, okay, granted, the analysis of our beliefs and preferences is compelling. We do have this personal notion of probability that's out there, that's not out there, that's within us, that measures our level of belief in something being true. But in addition to it, there's this physical thing out there, this objective probability. We don't really know what it is, but it's tied into our subjective probability by a principle of rationality. And that principle says, suppose there's some event that's going to happen, I know that the objective chance, whatever that thing is, of this event happening is P. There is only one rational choice. I've got to say the subjective probability I grant to that is P. If you believe that principle, which I haven't defended at all yet, if you believe that principle, then you can show that you will behave as if those inference and decision links between probability and what we do are true. In other words, you will, if you're in front of a long run of statistics, you will tentatively come to believe the objective probability of the event is given by those frequencies. And you will bet according, and more transparently, you will bet according to the objective probabilities if you know what they are. All right, so that doesn't answer what the objective probability is, but it sort of gives a framework for how to answer it, because you can say the following. What's objective probability? It's whatever physical property of the world makes that principle true. We don't know what that property is yet, but to be probability is to be the thing that makes the principle true. To be probability is to be something, some objective feature of the world, that you're rationally compelled to bet probability. But does that make objective probability a subjective, observer-dependent notion, nonetheless? No, it doesn't. The claim is that these probabilities will be some physical thing in the world, but the reason we call those things probability is linked to how rational agents behave. So let me give you an analogy to see whether that makes sense. Okay, this is a $10 bill. It's a physical object. It's made of atoms. It's there, and will continue being there. The whole of the human race vanishes and disappears. It's physical, you can describe it atomically, you can say all the intrinsic facts about the money by talking about its microatomic structure. But why is it money? It's money because of, why is it a $10 bill rather than some bit of paper? Why is this a $10 bill and this just a piece of paper? Answer, because of a certain set of rational, or irrational, behavior principles that the human race, and particularly the Canadians, have adopted. And it's because of that particular physical object's presence in a certain scheme which is subjective, which is chosen by an agent, that makes that perfectly objective object money. And the claim is that that's how we're going to understand objective probability, whatever objective probability turns out to be. It's going to be some physical property of the world, and it's going to be, it would be just as there if all the human race died off. But what makes it rational and right for us to call it probability is this principle about how rational agents behave. Okay, well, none of that said what the hell it could be. I mean, the principle is fine, but who says something like that is true for anything at all? So here's some candidates, what it might be true about. What about frequencies? Couldn't we say the objective probability is long-run frequency? Maybe long-run in the sort of long-term finite limit, rather than infinite limit. And then we'd say, well, the principle links this objective probability, which is long-run frequency, to our subjective betting. And that's fine, only if you can argue why we should bet according to frequency. So suppose you know, for the sake of argument, suppose you know that this atom, if you want, I've got 10 copies of this atom, and you know somehow, goodness knows how, that I'm going to measure this, that if I measure this at these 10 atoms, on 7 of those measurements I'll get spin up, and on 3 of them I'm going to get spin down. But in fact, you're not going to measure all 10 of them, you're going to measure one of them, and then you're going to give up physics. So the physics seems to say there's a probability of 0.7 of that atom turning to spin up. If you want to bet on whether to spin up, you should bet the probability of 0.7. Why should that follow from the fact that if you measured all 10 of these, 7 of them would actually be spin up and 3 of them would be spin down? So what? You're not going to measure 10 of them. So there's no obvious way in which you can really uncertainly tie frequencies to probabilities. Well, how about something else? I mean, a term that's sort of in vogue among some physicists, among some philosophers, is a thing called propensity. Maybe probabilities, these primitive things in the world, these primitive physical quantities, they're not analyzable in terms of frequencies or something like that. They're just primitive, they're there. But then you've got to ask, why is this physical thing the sort of thing that you should bet according to? And it's very clear to see why that should be the case. You could say, well, we'll just stipulate it. We'll just make the principle, one of our laws of physics. We'll say as a law of physics that rational agents are compelled to bet according to these principles. Okay, now you could do that. Then the evidence interpretation is fine as well. It would say it's a law of physics that it's rational to bet according to multiple amplitude. But of course, that's not okay. We shouldn't be having rationality principles as part of our basic laws of physics. Rationality is not supposed to go that deep. When we list all the microscopic things that our ultimate theory is going to include, they're probably going to include things like fields. Maybe they include quantized chunks of space-time or cosmic strings or superstrings or something. They're presumably not going to include the liberations of rational agents. So rationality principles are not the sort of thing that has any fundamental role in physics. So we've got a problem. What are these objective probabilities? And independent of the ethical interpretation, what are these objective probabilities? And one of the things that, from a more philosophical point of view, that's interesting about the ethical interpretation is it offers a new candidate. No one previously, bizarre, had thought that objective probability might be the amplitude, the multiple amplitude in the quantum branching process. I mean, why that didn't occur in the 19th century? But from that point of view, we can see how we've got a framework for how the evidence interpretation might want to think about probabilities. And if it succeeds in thinking about probabilities that way, it might achieve something that's not just an answer to the interpretation of quantum mechanics, but also solves a sort of long-standing conceptual problem quite apart. And that strategy would go something like this. Can we prove that the mod squared amplitudes are the sort of thing that rational agents are rationally compelled to bet according to? So, in other words, can we prove that if a certain event, the outcome of quantum measurement, has mod squared amplitude B, relative to your initial amplitude, obviously, because in the many worlds situation, my amplitude is very small because there's lots of other copies of me that are competing with the amplitude. But if we can prove that, relative to me, a certain event in the future branching pattern has mod squared amplitude P, then I'm rationally compelled to behave as if I assigned subjective probability P to that event. Can we prove it? Claim. If we can prove it, if you buy the framework I've given generally, what we will have proved is that mod squared amplitude is objective probability. And along the way, we'll have shown that there is one definite candidate for objective probability that works, and that's one more than we have.
From a logical point of view, this is a necessary condition when something is objective probability is not satisfied with simplification. Is it also sufficient in the sense that you can identify something to identify something that satisfies this equation?
Oh, I see what you mean. So what about if there were two different such things? Well, there were two scenarios. Suppose there were two different such things which describe a different probability to some events. So maybe there's probability number one ascribes probability half to this event, and probability number two ascribes probability a quarter to this event. Now that couldn't happen, because then the principle would say you're rationally compelled to bet at odds of half and a quarter. What you could have maybe is two different things that sort of agreed, but you sort of, in principle, might be a problem, but you sort of might imagine that actually in practice, when it happens in physics, you usually find that they're just some mathematical transforms of one another. Can I tell you how many times, Andy? So the main thing I'm going to move on to talk about is going to be how, if we can, actually, whether that principle is proven. So does anyone have any sort of questions?
Did Wittgenstein play the role of the rational agent in this? It seems that you need a rational agent.
Yeah.
So is that okay? Or what happens in the universe where there might be no rational agents?
Well, suppose you ran this principle okay. What you want to say about that universe would be these things would still be probabilities, so you really still would have a probabilistic structure. But it would be perhaps less helpful to talk in terms of those probabilities. So why do we find probabilities interesting and use this sort of seductive terminology, probability? Answer because of how that ties into how a rational agent would act. The weights will still be there. The claim is going to have an identification weight equals probability, but you might find that using the word probability was not a helpful thing to do in describing this empty universe. You might just want to talk about the weights. It's not the same structure, the same reality.
Then the weights, what do the weights mean then?
Well, you can argue and you can say what. They mean something internally to the theory. I mean, it's sort of like saying what does the electric field vector mean? You can give operational statements about what it does, but to some extent, saying what is it beyond this mathematical structure and how it fits in with the other stuff in the theory is not necessarily makes sense. So the problem we have here is not. I don't think the problem is that we have a theory that is incoherent. I think any sort of consistent mathematical structure you could imagine will. A world could be like that. The question is more, can we tie it in? Can we say it's our world? Does it tie into our the quantum measurements we make? And of course, when we look at the measurements we make, then agents are avoidable. Anyone else want to ask anything?
Can you just explain the slide
about
what is exactly the principle
text? Yeah, sure.
Can you just
explain
the principle?
So it's basically saying something like, suppose I am told by God that the objective, or from my best scientific theory, doesn't mean to be magical, that the probability of this atom decay, whatever that means, is one third. Then for that statement to be true, so the objective probability of the atom decaying is one third, then for that statement to be true, I must assign subjective probability to one third of that event. In other words, there must be some way in which I ascribe a different probability, a different subjective probability to that decay, you can call it. You can say, you were being irrational, and here's why. Or to say, you might want to say, well, look, this is a primitive principle of rationality. It's sort of as fundamental as Newton's law or something. And as I say, I think that's actually not a bad idea.
Isn't that circular? isn't that saying, if I know this to be true, then I have to believe this to be true, but isn't that, well, knowing is just another way of saying I believe in this really, really strongly?
It's certainly as God tells me the probability is. Oh, sorry, I see English. So if the search answer, because how do you know the probability was? Yeah, okay. It's not a search narrative, although it's complication. If you start the situation where you happen, for whatever reason, who knows why, to give subjective probability one to the atom, to the objective probability being third, then you have to give subjective probability one third to its decay. If in fact you only give subjective probability one half to it being objective probability one third, and you give subjective probability half to it being objective probability naught, then you can prove from the principle you've got to use the weighted sum. So you can fit it in. And in fact, if you look at, if you want to prove that sort of inferential link, in other words, how can we get from frequency to probabilities, the way it works is you start off by imagining that you've got some fairly arbitrary distribution of subjective probabilities over the objective probability being one of the set of possible numbers. And then you look at a long line of evidence and you see that you're going to, that's going to sort of move your subjective probabilities, so you start becoming more and more persuaded.
Well, if you're assuming that your intelligent agents use induction principle, right? If they see the sun come up again and again and again, then eventually they'll believe that the sun will come up tomorrow.
I'm assuming that the agent has credence one, subjective probability one, that all the atoms are the same. So in other words, any property one has all the atoms. Now you can say, how does he know that? And good question. That's the general principle of induction. Induction is a genuine series of problems which I don't think have a solution. But of course, it's a problem across the board. It's not specific to many worlds.
You were describing before how subjective probability can be more or less deduced from a set of axioms which are thought of as intuitively rational principles.
Yeah.
And you described this as an atom of rational behavior. Is the sense in which this is rational deducible from the subjective principles that subjective probability.
Oh, sorry.
The rationality you're describing here is not contained in the subjective principles.
What the objective probabilities are. The claim is from a certain candidate for the principal principle to be true of a certain. I've got this thing, this candidate for objective probability. Call it F. So the claim is, can I, starting with the physical properties of Earth and some intuitively rational, valid principles of rationality, can I derive the principle for Earth? If I can, O is probability. If I can't, it's not. That's okay. The claim structure. And I'm going to go through that for the multiple amplitude in the end of the picture.
So the idea is that this should be a template for objective probability rather than a template for rational behavior.
Yeah, that's right. So you could imagine it's not logically impossible, but there just isn't anything to it. Writing that down doesn't make any concrete claim about rationality absent knowing what objective probability is. I could write down the rather less principle, which says if a rational agent knows the objective squirrel quantity of something is X, then he should jump your leg. You could write that principle down. Now, the obvious conclusion for that is nothing has squirrel quantity, because there's no thing out there such that whatever the circumstances you see, it should jump your leg. So that would just be showing that definition's empty. And maybe that definition's empty too. Claim it's not empty for the multiple amplitudes in quantum mechanics in the evidence definition. Thank you.
Trying to clarify my
point. Yeah.
Is this right? We have the principle in a purely classical induction probability.
Yes.
Am I right to think what you're really doing is offering a variant of the Everett principle, something else? You don't really need to go by the general problem. You just want to say if a rational agent knows what size squared equals A,
I think it's a difference for category rather than a fundamental difference. Because suppose the principle was true for the multiple amplitude, then we would know that if an agent knows the multiple amplitude of P, he assigns subjective probability of P to X, and we wouldn't need to talk about objective probability. But that's equally true if it turns out that the long run frequency is objective probability. Then we'd have shown that if a rational agent knows the long run frequency of X is P, he's rationally required to assign subjective probability. So objective probability is just the name we give to whatever thing plugs into this gap. So I'm claiming that's the right analysis of the concept of objective probability generally. So classically, I don't think it's true, but classically we tend to assume objective probability is something like long-run frequency. So the claim would be, if that's true, then it ought to be possible to prove that it's rational to bet on according to the long-run frequencies. And if we could prove that, that would establish that long-run frequency was indeed probability, and that would be what it would be for long-run frequency.
But you could run the argument without
being totally notion of objective probability. Yes, you can. I mean, the reason I'm doing it with objective probability is to try to make the point that we're not constructing some sort of alternative to just general use of probability talk. We're constructing a candidate for it. So you wouldn't be able to say, well, look, this is perfectly, we know what probability is, we know objective probability. Sorry, let me start again, this is a good general point. You might want to have said, well, look, we know what objective probability is, it's this thing or that thing or the other thing in classical physics. That can't be the open interpretation, therefore the open interpretation doesn't have probabilities in, physics have probabilities in, therefore something's wrong. So the claim is actually what the objective probabilities in the world are is rather subtle than that, and we don't really know what they are. They're this sort of thing that we think is out there because science seems to use them a lot, but we don't have any good candidates for it. So the claim is actually objective probability all along has been every probability is never new. I think I better move on. Okay, so that's a program to adopt. What we want to do is somehow prove that if I know that the mod squared amplitude of something is p, I should detonate at odds p to 1 minus p. Okay, so that seems to be saying, well, look, you're an agent in an ever-acting universe. You know there's going to be some branching event going on. Your only choice is to bet according to the branching amplitudes. Now, see if that's obviously wrong, because it seems there are loads and loads and loads of different betting rules you can adopt. And in particular, there's one which seems a much, much better candidate, and that one says something like this. I've got a branching event. Here's a measurement here. It's a bit fuzzy, so you've got decoherence going on. But here are branches going off. I've got two branches. There's a me in each of them. Here's me before the measurement. So I've got two successes. So I should weight them up equally. I should weight this guy half, and I should weight this guy half. And this guy can't detect the amplitude. This guy can't detect the amplitude. So why should I care about the amplitude? The amplitude's not playing any role in the life of me or my successes, so why care about it? And that's quite persuasive, superficial. But there are two rather serious things wrong with it. And I'm going to use this partly to show, because I think this one is often people's sort of intuitive what we ought to do, so it's worth showing why it's wrong with it. But I hope also in showing it, you might give some idea about how strong the constraints are going to be on a rule that actually makes sense. Okay, because here's what might happen. Here's one of the two problems of the thing. Maybe, at this point, this guy makes another measurement. And again, there's now two guys, 1 meter branch. This guy doesn't make a measurement. Right, so, this guy assigns probability, he'll assign probability half here. So the probability I would assign is half times a half, which is 40. But you could say, well look, this whole thing is one big involved quantum measurement, which happens to have an intermediate step. And who cares how the measurement is done? At the end of it, I've got three successes, this guy, this guy, this guy. So why don't I say one-third, one-third, one-third? Which is contradictory to my predicted postulate. So in a world where there's lots of splitting going on all the time, it might be fine if there's only one splitting event yet, but in a world where there's lots of splitting going on all the time, then the count number of branches rule is inconsistent across time. It does something which a principle of rationality that Ben and Ock requires to do, which is it makes us make different decisions for the same physical situation according to the different rules we use to describe it. If we describe it as being one measurement and another measurement, we get one result. If we describe it as being one big measurement and an intermediate step, we get a different result. So we've got a contradiction. There's a second problem. And the second problem is with this notion of counting at all. Now remember where the worlds came into our story in the first place. They came in out of decoherence. This is supposed to be some effective, higher level structure that's come out of decoherence.
Okay, so a
model it might be, I'm going to measure. Yeah, okay, so one might imagine I start with some system that's in a state alpha up plus beta down. And I measure spin on that system and I get alpha up. Up. Plus beta down. So that's the third set of branching. But then you might imagine, if I get up, then I find it so exciting to measure a quantum spin path and get up, I want to do it all over again. But I'm going to down past the decrescent piece, I don't bother doing it. So if you imagine doing that, then the branching structure afterwards is going to be something like alpha squared up, up, up. No, I didn't think. Oh, I'm going to make it a new particle. I'm going to bring in a second auxiliary particle here. So I've got a bag which contains lots of these particles. I'm not including them before this. So I just bring another one out of the bag and make a black one too. Yes, thank you. I did. Yeah. So I've got alpha squared up, 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 plus alpha beta up, down. Up, down, plus beta squared, I think. Beta squared, down. Down, comma, can't be bothered, which includes somewhere in it the state of the network for measuring. So I've got this two-stage process. Firstly, I measure the first spin half particle, and then if I get a spin up, I measure another one. Yep.
I think that should just be beta, or you should have your second.
Oh, yeah, of course, we should, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so here's the setup. So I measure spin on my first particle, and I get something that looks like that, where I've suppressed the sort of as yet unmeasured particle. And then if I get spin up, I make another measurement of another identical set particle. And that's the branching that happens on the left-hand side there. So at the end of the whole process, what I've got is three branches, an up-up branch, an up-down branch, and a down-front-bottom branch. Three branches, counting rules says probability of third, third, third. But if I look at the intermediate step, I conclude something different. I conclude half-half, and then this half branch splits into two branches, which get a quarter, half-half, half-half. So in other words, two different descriptions of exactly the same physical system tell me to do different things, take different bets. So there's an internal incoherence in the counting rule. And there's also a physical impossibility in it, because this branching structure is a higher level thing defined by the incoherence. It's not written into the framework of the Earth, of the world at the beginning of time. When we make this branching structure, what we're doing is we're seeing a certain pattern in the decoherent places when we look at a very sort of coarse grain level, when we trace over lots and lots of the environment. Even when we trace over bits of the environment, we didn't need to trace over. This is a very coarse description. If you imagine a real experiment where you make a spin up, you're not just going to have one successor where you make a spin up. You're going to have millions of different successes where different internal states of the apparatus end up in slightly different configurations, even though you can't notice that. So actually, somehow this branch ought to be reflecting millions and millions of branches. How many branches? Well, try find really. Try looking closer and closer. And what you'll find is as you look closer and closer, you don't ultimately get down to the real answer. All that happens is that as the branches get more and more fine-grained, there comes a point where it starts being inappropriate to say that they're decoherent to each other. And there comes a point a little bit after that where it's definitely inappropriate to say they're decoherent. And at that point, you just have to abandon your talk of branches. You've gone to a level where that emergent structure is no longer a helpful way of describing things. You've just got to talk of them for bare quantum state. But there's no last step in that progression where you can count the number of worlds. All there is a fuzzing where the number of worlds gets more and more and more, but starts becoming fuzzier and fuzzier and less well-defined and less valid, and then eventually you get down to a pure quantum state. So the actual idea of counting a number of worlds is simply not defined in the open circuit. You can't say there are six worlds which spin up, you can't say there are 6 times 10 to the power of 10 to 12 worlds which spin up. All you can say is there are some worlds which spin up. World is defined in terms of you can take a chunk of the wave function and say that corresponds to branches in which spin up is measured, but you can't say, and there are three of them. So there are two major problems with the counting rule. One of them is it's completely incoherent because of the cross-time situations. One of them is it can't actually be defined in physics anyway.
So if I have a configuration space or whatever,
yep,
there's chunks over there, of course I can count them.
Sure, but your configuration space has got chunks of it here because you decide to trace over a quite large chunk of a much bigger configuration space. Trace over a bit less of it.
So I just have my home universe here, and I see these chunks. They're already declared, so there's no further declared.
I don't think you will see it. Well, I don't think you will necessarily see it because you've now got your entire global space. You've got no, you don't have an environment structure now to pick out your decoherent structure.
So you're saying that there won't be chunks of words.
Yeah, the chunks of a pattern realized not in the configuration representation of the entire universe, but the configuration space representation of a big subsystem of the universe. You don't see the structure when you look at the entire Hilbert space because you've got to trace out quite a lot before the structure from this. So throw away a lot of the details into before stuff is there.
Anthony? Can I ask about
the only one. It's the only one. And that's true. Yep. Just about.
Just to clarify. So yeah. My whole universe consists of a mesh in apparatus and a fiber. That's all there is. If I do a mesh now, it's going to branch out. It's going to be chunks like this. And I tend to count.
I have no idea what's saying to yourself. So fortunately, the universe doesn't consist of a meshing reference.
But suppose it is. So assume this. Can I count them?
I don't know.
You don't know. I say I can. It's chunks. I count them. It's easy.
I'm slightly pressed for time. I don't think you're right, as in I don't think there'll be a problem here. But suppose there is a problem, then maybe all that would show is if the entire universe was your system and hijacked, then you wouldn't be able to see problems. But it is.
So,
I think I'm going to move on. Okay, so having sort of that, think about it as a sort of preamble. We're not going to be able to define a counting rule for two important reasons. And those reasons are going to knock all sorts of other methods to define rules. And what we're going to try to prove is that actually there's only one rule that works, and it's the Borg rule. And here's how the proof works. It's going to go in two steps. The first step, we're going to prove if we have two events that have the same weight, have the same mod squared amplitude, then agents have to give them the same probability as each other. And that's been called the equivalence rule. And then we're going to say, if we prove the equivalence rule, we're going to sort of bootstrap that up from equivalence to the whole probability curve. And I'm basically only going to talk about one and not about two. And you can see intuitively how two is going to work. If you prove that equal weight events have the same amplitude, then you can see how the results, equal weight events have the same subjective probability. Then you're going to be able to show that the world is broken into 10 equally weighted branches or 100 equally weighted branches or something. Then each of them would have probability 100. You're going to then build branches up from other branches, and then you're going to get all the sort of rational weighted branches that way, and you're going to get the irrational weighted branches from that possibility. And there's an example of how that's going to go in the assignment for these two lectures, but I'm not going to go through it today. The thing I want to focus on is what I think is the sort of more conceptually core thing, which is how do we even get started on the process? How do we go from a situation where there are two equally weighted branches, two saying those branches have to be equally probable? So, here's how we might do it. Suppose we've got the following situation. We've got a particle, its superposition of spin up and spin down, not necessarily equally weighted, and we're going to make a bet on what the answer is. Specifically, we're going to bet $10 that it's going to turn out to be spin up. And for convenience, we don't lose a safe if it turns out to spin down. So here's where we might work. We've got three systems in the game here. The first system is the spin half particle measurement. The second system is some measurement device that's also a payoff device. It's basically an ATM plugged into a payoff device. And the third system is the agent itself. And inside the device state, if you like, you can assume a sort of environment that they care about. So the process comes in four steps. Firstly, we're going to pair the system in this superposition of up and down. Then the device is going to measure it. Then according to the measurement results, the device is going to pay out. And there's a fourth optional step we might do or might not, where we just throw away the result from measurement. So we've got the result, we don't care. So first step, we prepare the state. And the second step, we have an evolution like this. So if it goes from up, if you've got an up state going in, you get a spin up out. And if you get a down state, you get a spin down. Now that spin up state is an entangled state of some sort of the spin half particle going in and the original measurement device. Maybe it's just got a tensor product form. Maybe it's actually up cross device measures spin up. Maybe not. The measurement device is allowed to destroy the system being measured. It doesn't matter. So whatever it is, the evolution says, if I input spin up state, then I get spin up and outcome and dismiss it down. then I pay out. Again, the rule's pretty obvious. If the measurement reverses in the spin-up state, it stays in the spin-up state and the agent gets a dog, gets $10. If it's in the spin-down state, then it stays in the spin-down state and the agent gets nothing. And the fourth step, the throwaway step, delete the result step, if you like, you've got some big collection of junk states. They all correspond to throwing the device into a, I don't know, a volcano or something. Yeah.
I just don't see how this formulation accepts rash relations, though, because that's a slightly bigger choice. And it seems it says they have to make every choice. It's acceptable.
Because of many wells, do you?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, because the theory doesn't say that it needs to be a branch or a negative effect. There might be, it depends on the brain's random.
But if you assume quantum is fundamental, then you have to consider that it's some finite state.
Well, yeah, they're out there somewhere very distant from me, but I don't think that anyone I need to think about people in Eritrea. Yeah, they might look quite similar to you, but they're not me.
But I don't see how it makes rationality, because the deterministic process that would be making
decisions, or was it into a rational agent behaving? How do you get the rational agent? I think that was the premise of your question. How do you get the rational behavior within the swing of deterministic unitary evolution?
I think that's a deep question, and I think actually it wouldn't be any less deep if we had indeterministic evolution. Ultimately, there's a deep philosophical and, I guess, cognitive science question of how freely acting agents can coexist with a theory that tells you what happens in a microscopic level. How is it the case that we can save this guy from that, but I'm rational when actually everything I do is determined by the neural structure of my brain? I don't think there are easy answers to that question, but I also think it's a problem that goes right across physics or any attempt at a sort of physical theory of how the mind works.
Come back to this here. Your picture cannot be good then, right? If you ask that I cannot count words, because in this picture I can count them.
The
picture must be misrepresented.
I think I don't mind coming back to the counting words later, but I don't want to jump back to the lecture when we moved on from there.
Because I'm very confused about this when you said you can count words. You've got 1, 3.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to throw away the result from measurement. We might choose to. Doing step 4 is optional. So we don't, because the throwing away is going to be something like a smash the machine with a hammer or something. So we don't know the quantum process that does the throwing away. But we know there's some big set of states you might take instead. There's a set of junk states, and I've indexed them sort of with I and J later. So we don't, the throwaway process is something of that form. We don't know which process of that form, but it's a throwaway process of some sort. Okay, now. After we've done the first three steps, after we've done preparation, measurement, payoff, but we haven't deleted it, here's the state the system's in. So we've got two chunks. In the alpha chunk, the alpha branch, we have spin up and a $10 payout. In the beta branch, we have spin down and the agent getting nothing. After deletion, the spin up and spin down states get changed to junk states. So we know after deletion, the state's going to be something like this. So I've labeled it by up to say we've made the better up, by alpha and beta, which are the amplitudes of the initial state, and by I and J, which are the labeled junk states. And let's say the set of all such junk states, or sort of all such dispositions after deletion, is this thing, S up of alpha and beta. So it's got all the possible states we might end up in after preparation, measurement, payout, deletion. Now, here's the important step. The agent is uninterested in what junk is, by assumption. He's smashing up the device because it feels like. He doesn't mind whether it's destroyed or not. Or some other guy's coming in to smash the apparatus up. He doesn't mind. In particular, he doesn't mind which junk state it ends up in. They're all the same. He neither knows nor cares how he delete it. Which means he's indifferent between all the states in S up, L, B. So suppose you said to this guy, all right, I'm going to give this object the same there, but I'm going to change the deletion process. Before deleting the result, I'm going to move the device a millimeter that way. The agent would say, I don't care, I'm not interested in the device anymore, I've got my money, I'm leaving. Or maybe I haven't got my money, I'm selfie. But either way, the device is not interesting. So from the agent's point of view, all the states in this S up space are equivalent. Furthermore, he doesn't care whether you did the deletion or not. He doesn't actually mind. Yeah, you could have deleted him. He's got the results. The bet's over. Maybe if you want to leave the apparatus as a living memorial to what the result was, he's perfectly relaxed about that. Do what you like. So he doesn't actually mind whether we've got some state in S up or whether we've got the original state psi up. Okay, that's spin out. Now, what about spin down? The story's pretty much the same. Same arrangement. So now I'm going to do exactly the same. I'm going to bet on spin down rather than spin up. So there's now a psi naught down state, which is an alpha superposition that's weighted alpha spin up, no payout, and beta spin down, take off payout. And then after the deletion, I'm going to place spin up and spin down with some junk state. Those should be labeled as items, actually, sorry, it's been left off. So those, that should be an I and a J again. And instead of the junk state for a down measurement is S down of alpha beta. Now, here's the important step. S down of alpha and beta is the same set as S up of beta and alpha. Because to be a state in S down of alpha beta, you've got to be a state where one of the branches is alpha junk nothing, and one of them is beta junk $10. But to be in the up state is to be exactly that the other way around. So all, the only difference between the generic state and the up state and the generic state and the down state is the alpha and beta swap. But so now we've got these two equivalences going on. The agent doesn't mind, if you tell him that you're going to have one state in S down alpha beta, he doesn't mind which one it is. And if you tell him you're going to have that state, he doesn't mind whether you have that state or something in this space. And the same thing's going on in the outer space. That's not a subspace, that's just a literal enumeration of states. So any state that's in S down alpha beta is in S up beta alpha. Because any such state, here are the two states and two cases. You see the psi down alpha beta is alpha junk nothing plus beta junk 10. And the up one is alpha junk 10 plus beta junk nothing. Yeah. Okay, so you can see those two at the same time. Now, consider the particular case where alpha and beta are the same. In that case, obviously, S down half equals S up half. If beta and alpha are the same, then the measurement will, the actual state we'll get after the measurement will be in the same set of states, all of which I'm indifferent to, no matter whether I bet an up or down. Whether I bet an up or down, I know that the state will be some superposition of, with something before, 1 over root 2, some junk $10 payout, plus 1 over root 2, some different junk $10 payout. So the agent has to be indifferent between those two situations because they're the same situation described in different ways. So we have an agent who is, firstly, he doesn't care whether he takes the state where we don't delete, where we put a bet on down and don't delete the result, against the state where we bet on down and do delete the result. Secondly, if we bet on down and we do delete the result, he doesn't care how we do it. Thirdly, if he makes the bet on up, he doesn't care whether after he gets the payout you do delete or don't delete the result. Fourthly, if you bet on up and you delete the result, he doesn't care how you do the deleting. And fifthly, if you do the up bet and delete result, you get one of the states in the same set as if you do the down bet and delete result. So he's indifferent between all of these steps, which, if you put it all together, means he's indifferent between whether you took the up bet or the down bet. Now let me show you that in a slightly simplified form that doesn't use so much deletion, because the deletions there should represent vaguely physically doable operations. Let's suppose actually we can do what you might call perfect deletion. So in perfect deletion, you don't have all this junk stuff. You very reliably put the system back into its sort of initial reset state. So here's how that might work. Let's see if that was. So in that situation, this simplified model, which is simpler than that one, that shows the basics of what's going on in a less realistic way, then you basically the agent after the measurement is in some state like alpha up dollar payoff plus beta down no payoff. And suppose we now delete the result by rotating the down state into an up state. So we're going to leave the system in an up state no matter what. So this is a very sort of simple deletion. Or even better, let's suppose that there's some this is a spin one particle, we'll just kick it into a sort of neutral state if you weren't using. So call the neutral state just blank or something. So I'm going to do the transformation, up dollar goes to black dollar and down nothing goes to black nothing. That's my deletion operation. That'll take me to the state alpha nothing dollar. Plus beta, nothing, the payout. So that's what happens if I measure spin up and then do deletion. And of course, the important thing again, the agent doesn't care about deletion. He doesn't mind if he gets this state or this state. spin up. If you spin down, it's going to be alpha up. No pace, this is the best you'll spin down, so if you spin up, you get nothing. Plus beta, downstate, dollar. And after deletion, that will go to alpha, null, nothing, plus beta, null, dollar. Okay, so we're saying the agent is indifferent between this state and that state, and it's indifferent between this state and that state. But if alpha equals beta, then that state is that state. You know, the quantum mechanics doesn't care whether you've got A plus B or B plus A. So in the event that alpha is beta, and only if alpha is beta, the agent is indifferent between this state and that state, indifferent between this state and that state, and that state and that state are the same. Therefore, he's indifferent between this state and that state, which is to say, he doesn't mind whether he bets $10 on it being spin up, or whether he bets $10 on it being spin down. And that is to say, if you work that out, the only probability that's consistent with that is to say he gives a 50% probability of being spin up and a 50% probability of being spin down.
So to achieve
that deletion process,
you
mean
the
auxiliary
system, which would
include
the auxiliary
system,
which
doesn't
have
the deletion, and stays only the same in the line. That's why I'm using the junk stuff. So if you're worried about the technical issues, that's what the junk thing is for, I guess, across it. But in principle, you can construct the Hamiltonian. It's a Hamiltonian that has a very weird structure. It's conditional on what this state is for that. So there will be any transformation that does that. The coolness is going to work because this state won't be the same as that state, but they'll both be in the same junk space. And we've already established that the agent doesn't care which junk space state he gets. So that's the core result of the core mathematical result of the talk, actually, but the core result that's going to underpin an ever-etching story about probability. So, claim, I'm not going to go through it. Once you've got that result, you can bootstrap it up to the probability rule right across the board. So that's saying, so we've shown here that if an agent knows the state of equilibrium superposition of up and down, he's rationally compelled to put probability 0.5 on getting up and 0.5 on getting down. We bootstrap that up to show that if the superposition gives mod squared amplitude p, regardless of p, to getting spin up, the agent is rationally compelled to bet on getting spin up using probability p. That is, we've shown the principle to be true for the quantum amplitudes, which, as I was arguing before, shows that the quantum amplitudes are probability. So that sort of program coming from decision theory is quite recent in the Edward interpretation. Going back to work by David Deutsch in 1999, continued by various people since then, and I think actually cast a very different light on what has been one of the most serious problems in the Edward interpretation. So we move from a situation where we don't know how to think about probability in the interpretation to a situation where maybe, if you believe the argument, we don't just know how to think about it now, we also know how to think about probability more generally. We have a candidate on the table for the sort of thing probability could be, which we never really had before. So both philosophically and physically, I think it's a very interesting result. Okay, I'm pretty much done.
The way you play the argument there, it seems that you're using some kind of symmetry between the jumps and get from up to down.
Yeah.
Is argument that does it survive? Because there's an electron and positron, or if you use particles that, satisfy some current symmetry gradient, where, in fact, by physical process, you won't be able to get the same jump.
Yes.
So, can you get away with
that? Yes, I think you can, because the agent is going to, you can always have some auxiliary system sitting by there to sort of swap it around. You've got a situation where from the same starting point you could set up those these bets. So say one of them's on the electron, one of them's on the neutron or something, and then the other one is always sitting there. So you can always just expand your junk process to take it in. Okay, so before I finish, I promise I'd say something quickly about non-mechanical interpretation. So as I sort of hinted last time, the Bell's theorem doesn't work in different interpretation. It doesn't work for a very simple reason. Bell's theorem assumes that there is actually a unique result from each of the measurements. It assumes that you actually get a measurement from each side. In the other interpretation, you just don't get that. From the individual observer's point of view, from God's eye view, you just get all the results here and get all the results here. So there's just basic assumption in the theorem that doesn't get through. Does that mean the other interpretation is local? Well, it doesn't. It depends what you mean by local. Being loose and crude and qualitative, this isn't the main focus I want to talk about. There are two notions of non-mechanics that we have. Non-local interactions, non-local states. So non-local interaction means action distance. I do something here, and in the Andromeda galaxy right now, something happens to consequence. I wiggle something here, and then the Andromeda galaxy something wiggles. That sort of thing is going to give you conflict relativity that you're very careful. The Everett interpretation doesn't have anything like that. Interactions in the Everett interpretation are completely robust and local. It does, however, have something different. It has non-local states. So you have a non-local state where I tell you everything about this region of space, I tell you everything about this region of space, but I haven't yet told you everything about these two regions of space jointly. The Everett interpretation is non-local in that sense because of entanglement. So the Everett interpretation takes the state completely literally. Entanglement taking literally clearly tells you about non-local properties of a system which are not made up of its subsystems. So the Everett interpretation is relaxed about the fact that states are non-local even though interactions are local. There's mildly conversion literature, I should say, and people are dead Deutsch side against that, but I don't want to get into controversy here. State non-locality is not a problem there. It's an odd feature of the world, but quantum mechanics is weird. It doesn't clash with relativity. You have a completely covariant non-local theory of states. Okay, so I'm going to finish up. They will ask me to do a sort of strength and weakness stuff at the end of this, so here's a vague catching out. Advances disregard the ever-ending picture. Basically, advances, as I stressed a lot in the last lecture, it's a pure interpretation. You don't need to change the formulas, you don't need to change the equations, just take quantum mechanics as it is. And as such, it is the Lorentz covariant. That's given just for the fact that the pure quantum theory has a Lorentz covariant from Hamiltonian, you haven't added anything to the pure quantum theory. Some of the emergent structures aren't the Lorentz covariant, but that's not a problem. In the Earth is a Lorentz covariant. The Earth is a Lorentz covariant. But at the fundamental level, the theory is the Lorentz covariant. And, from a philosophical point of view, it's a completely realist theory. We're not being observers, we're not being insights of knowledge, we're simply literally interpreting the theory as given to us. Questions or problems? The most serious technical problem, I think, from a general physics point of view, is decoherence enough to give us the sort of structure we want? We don't have a sort of clean proof that decoherence will deliver the sort of branching structures everyone needs. We have a lot of plausibility. It's a lot of thought experiments, a lot of toy models, a lot of computer simulations. It's suggested, but it's not conclusive. It might then be conclusive. We don't have a sort of neat three-line or three-book proof that, that all living things can come out of it. We have some suggestions. So it might just be that we advance further and further along that. Even supposing it does this conceptual problem, do you want to buy the argument I gave about structural emergence of the world? If you want your worlds, or maybe your minds or your people, to be more robust than just structural objects, then I think the Everett interpretation will not work for you. And does that decision theoretic program answer the probability problem to your satisfaction? Does it go wrong in any of the various ways that have come up or that haven't come up? And the last problem, which I haven't brought up so far, is suppose all that's fine, can you believe the doubt? It literally, honestly says that there are innumerable, almost definitionally uncountable versions of me and you and everyone out there in all sorts of different states. The universe is vastly, vastly bigger than it is. And obviously, I've got no argument to respond to that. But to finish with an analogy, it's not the first time in science where we've taken really quite small data about little tweaks that where our theory is slightly wrong, and made the universe an awful lot bigger than we originally thought it was. If you look up into the night sky, you point your telescope detector up in the night sky, you get little twinkles and flicks. The stars in the sky are a pretty small distortion of our overall picture of the world. You wouldn't have to change our perception very much as not to have stars in the sky. And yet, on the basis of these tiny amounts of information filtering in from the night sky, we've moved from a sort of medieval picture of the universe where you just have the sun and the earth and the planets. We've moved to a universe vastly, possibly infinitely larger than that. This is the general route we go in physics. There's not necessarily anything wrong with it in the many worlds theory either. What's up there? Yeah, do you want to come back to focus it? Yeah, sure. No, John.
Okay, I suppose this is really probing that very last point there that you had in the post. So I wanted to ask, if there's people suffering in another branch, sorry for them. Do you feel less sorry if their branch has only a small amplitude?
I just think that had a strong view. I'm not sure. I wouldn't know that. I know that though intrinsically. I think that's quite an aggressive abstraction. It's not that I can do anything about that. I mean, changing my belief that the interpretation of quantum mechanics won't change what they exist. Can I prioritize questions from students, actually? There might be some students as well.
This might be a rather silly question, but I think you made a reference at one point saying that the other, that the world is factory weakening. How so? Like, I always just imagine all of being different, like, once they're separated, they're, like, saved by a
Well, they basically do in practice. The problem is that economic process is complete. You don't get a point where the coherence between branches completely stopped. So you'll find that you've got these two structures, considered different worlds. They have tails. The tails slightly overlap. There's a little bit of interference going on. Now, it's difficult to know whether the right way of catching out that interference is it slightly weakens the sense in which the structure's there in the first place, or it slightly causes the structure to interact with each other. But in either case, the practical size of the effect is way off the scale. So you know the moment you see it, so there's no prospect of picking up the telephone and talking to get another branch. Okay, for example.
Okay, let's say you have this little toy universe that only has like a big box of particles in it and a guy who's going to take measurements.
Yeah.
And he takes measurements of spin up, spin down, and spin up is what we're likely to have. After each measurement he takes, you split the universe so you get two particles. So if you look at the whole thing, it seems like you're going to get an equal chance of getting spin up or spin down, even though the probability is weighted towards spin up.
Okay, so you want to say, in that picture, this is related to your point, in that picture, can we resurrect a counter? Okay, so response to that, let me choose to response to that. Firstly, suppose we could, suppose there was a precise defined structure. We still couldn't use a counter rule because we'd just contradict ourselves. I mean, so the idea of counter, I mean, you could say literally, here's how many copies there are. In a world that's like that, you could say, well, look, there are 10 to the power of 35 branches at the moment, and in half of my spin, you know, and here's the spread of cysts across them, doesn't correspond to the ball. You could say that, but, what that's directly got to do with probability is neither here nor there. I've made a case that what probability has got to do is it's going to do with plugging into how I make decisions. So I'm just going to say, well, if you don't know, you close your eyes, you're not sure what to load worlds you're in. It's irrational for you to suppose that you're equally likely in each world. You ought rationally to bet on where you open your eyes for being one of the higher weight branches. Why? Because of the sort of proofs. Why couldn't your alternatives go to counting rule there? Because if you try to use that as your touchstone of rationality, you're contradictory. So that's sort of because of the sort of incidental issues. So that's a sort of response that assumes that branching structure is there. But let me try again to say why it's not there. Your theory's got you've got this guy in the lab, and he's got a whole bunch of atoms. But for that guy to exist to be a classical information processing system, you've also got to have a huge heat sink out here that's decohering him. That's actually defining him as a macroscopic structure and not making some sort of weird composite position. And that huge heat bath is inevitably going to, and there's going to be a lot more weirdness mixed in the behavior of the apparatus you've got. So you've got this huge clunky gadget that's actually doing the measurement of spin. So all of that stuff is going to mean that when you say there's a branch into two, you're actually going to have a branch into loads more than that. So we can take for instance how it's like a Geiger counter works when we multiply in the microscopic actual matrix. But what you're doing in all that is you're setting up sort of chain reactions where some little effect is bigger and bigger and bigger. And that chain reaction is sort of shot through with quantum randomness. So the presence of that chain reaction just causes you to have a huge amount of branching going on. And the way the branch is going to go, the way that process goes, is not going to be the sort of thing that will be nicely, cleanly broken up into one branch, two branches, three branches. It's going to be a sort of huge mess that you can keep fine-graining into more and more branches until eventually you reach the decoherence threshold, but you won't reach any exact point.
I don't see how you have higher weighted branching after each split. It
doesn't
seem like you have an even probability of being in any branch.
Well, I think you're going to have higher weighted branches by BF. By weight, do you mean multiple amplitude?
What are the probabilities of a decision will be what
we see? Okay, so the two things you might mean by weight. You might mean what I've called multiple amplitude. You could mean that. Or you could mean the personal subjective probability. So you want to say it's multiple amplitude. That's fine, that's just definitions. And then why does one branch have higher weight than others? Just because you put that in my hand. It's in the fact the particle works an equal weight to position. If you want to say weight means personal probability, and you want to say it seems that the probability, the personal probabilities should be half and half, then that's too quick and cheap. It might seem that way, but I try to present an argument that in fact it's not that way. So even if the superficially looks that it should be that way, provably it's not going to be that way. You can't actually behave rationally on that assumption. The assumption will fail.
So what this argument is asking students, because we have no problem if we look at the second, say, when the theory tells us, you know, we want to look at, like, the world are split up, like, just in half space, whatever. Yeah. So this argument says, well, we should use that as a basis of what we call probability.
Yeah, exactly. Or, I mean, taking out the word probability entirely for a minute just to show how it falls apart, it's actually saying, what it's a proof of is we should use the mod squared amplitude as the thing which we weight our rewards for when we decide how to bet. And then the claim is that what subjective probability is the thing we weight our rewards according to, and what objective probability is the objective feature of the world that corresponds to that.
So this like splitting coefficient, this is the fundamental thing that's half what we decide to do.
Exactly. Probability is the name we call it. The reason we call it probability is because rationally this is how this is what you do. But you can't sort of say separately. Other questions?
So one critique of Lambert's interpretation says that this doesn't provide for a notion of time-like trajectory, I think is the language used.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no history of events in the many branches. Has that just been resolved? That's still a standing concern.
Are you thinking it's for John Bellwell is about there being no sort of
actually, well, it's in Kent's against Lambert's interpretation.
Sure. Okay, so Alien's point, correct me if it's wrong, is basically if you're going to have a. So suppose what you think you need to have is a precise definition of branch. One of the things you're also going to have, and that's going to be something like maybe you choose a precise preferred basis, maybe it's position basis. Then that's not going to be enough because in addition to that, you've got a rule that says how do. So suppose I'm in this world which corresponds to position state X. What world do I. How's that world link up to the next world along? How's that evolve over time? So if you try to complete that, you might have that stuff that looks like it's very, very theory. So the way this would respond to it would be, firstly, we're not going to have a precise definition of that. We're going to have a sort of emergent structural definition. Worlds are not going to be fundamental components of our ontology. They're going to be emergent stuff. And second, the trajectory is then going to be the same way we look at the trajectories of other sort of emergent objects. Basically, we say, if you've got a thing here, and then you've got a structurally similar causally connected thing here, we just draw a line through them. If there was sort of a cleaner of worlds, throughout space, then we wouldn't be able to do that so effectively, but because we've actually got some spread across branching, you can do it rather more neatly. I don't know if that's the question.
I guess so. So, in fact, the picture isn't quite accurate. The branches aren't a basic graph you can use and put at different levels and reconnect them in a cyclic graph.
Well, in principle, you can reconnect them, but, and there's nothing to stop them reconnecting in principle, but in practice, decoherence brings a wedge. That's one of the things that gets by you.
You claimed at the end that this interpretation leaves no special roles for observers or measurements. And I believe I must misunderstand somehow, because your analysis uses this rational agent over and over again. Does the rational agent not have a special role? How have I misunderstood?
Sure. Yeah, fair point. Okay, so yeah, so I've said this is observatory, and I spent the last hour talking about agents. Okay, so let's read. It's observatory in the sense that I told you the complete theory. Without talking about agents or observers. Like, if I want to specify an alien interpretation, say, I've got to say what this state physically means is something about observers, probabilities, and things like that. So in the end of the case, that's not true. What the state physically means is just some stuff. Similarly, in some of the Debreu-Bohm theory, you don't need an agent to specify the Debreu-Bohm theory. You just say, there's some stuff, the wave function, there's some more stuff, the particles. Where the agents come in is in the sort of epistemological question. Does this theory fit our observations? Is it a reasonable explanation of the quantum mechanics we see in the laboratory? Is it actually a legitimate interpretation of quantum mechanics in that sense? So there you actually look at experiments, you're saying we do these experiments in the lab, does the evidence interpretation get the answers right? And that's where you've got to bring in your agent. But then it's not there in your sort of initial formulation of the theory. It's in there in your epistemology, is this theory true? And it's in there in your sort of prudential stuff, if this theory is true, what do we do? That's good. Kids, I'm not sure who's doing it. Can you call?
Well, another question.
I don't mind. I don't know if you mind going back to your previous talk on Tuesday. You're Schrodinger cat box. And now, in order to make this more interesting, I want to get some response from the cat afterwards. And so instead of getting the cat to set the box, I put someone much smarter, so let's say I put my supervisor in the box. Now, what you're saying is this box is not interactive with the rest of the world. So there's some amplitude that my supervisor dies, some amplitude that he doesn't.
Yeah.
Now, according to decoherence, if I see this my supervisor alone and the rest of the system, the supervisor is interacting, if he dies, he'll probably bled on the stage, whatever. So, in practice, there's decoherence. There's no way this process is reversible. But if the box is not interacting with the rest of the world, I could, in principle, if I were very rich, create an institute for
experimental physics,
yeah,
and apply the reverse unitary to the whole box.
Yeah.
There's nothing in principle that stops it from doing this.
Nothing.
So at the end of the day, I open the box, and what will my supervisor say? Right? At one end, the world split. There was a lab supervisor, dead supervisor. Afterwards, there's only one supervisor.
What does he say?
What does he say?
Well, he says what happened there, because you've renounced the beginning. You've reversed the integer transformation. And that in particular means you reverse the state of memory. So in fact, his recollections of what happened are delayed. So what he just says is, I just walked into the box. He might have some search questions to ask. Particularly if you got the process wrong. that's the answer to what you actually observed. By construction, you wouldn't have anything interesting to say. I mean, it's always true, isn't it? If you want to say what's actually happening in the box, then I think the best thing to say is you've got this magic sort of interaction-free box. Inside the box, there's enough internal environment for the supervisor's life to continue classically. So you'll have a branch instruction defined on some coarse grained observables in that box, and it would be right to say that there are two branches present. They're present until your institute sets itself up and corrects it, and then they destroy it because you do this weird non-classical transformation. I think that the central thing to say from the supervisor's point of view is that one supervisor dies immediately. There's then another supervisor who lives in the box for 20 years and then dies, because I think that all the structure that makes somebody that supervisor is vaporized when you reverse the transformation. So in a certain sense, the story from the supervisor's point of view is when he goes in the box, in a sense, he has two successors. One's the guy who lives in the box, he has three successors. One's the guy who's in the box and dies almost instantly from the cyanide release. One's the guy who's in the box for 20 years and then dies when he's sort of obliterating the transformation. And one's the guy who's sort of in stasis for 20 years and then carries on. But I mean, I think that's sort of getting into the metaphysical questions about what we mean by personal identity apart from the mechanics. Say it again. In principle, yes, in practice, no. You can't. The unitary transformation to bring two macroscopic superpositions together is impossible in practice. The bottom part is because it's too complicated. It's also impossible because once DKNs goes over sort of critical threshold, it's going out of light speed. So you can never. You can't get a cat back in the box these days. The information about the cat is going out faster than you can catch it.
Right, well, students are filing out maybe the. So I just have some questions.
Seems this is like something like this.
Who is offering us this, all these steps?
Yeah.
I can see, it seems that you've acquired a lot of extra structure. If you said, I have some preference for anything among all possible states that emerge from this experiment over the next 10 years, I can sort of see that. It seems to be required much more. You require that we have to have a preference that allows us to respond to any possible test that could be made on those arguments.
And
that seems to apply to the uniqueness of function net.
And then comes actually the answer.
Yeah, and so,
so
I mean, I can see that it applies to gasoline, where maybe you could be offered a great success, but I don't see that it applies to the real world. There's just lone agents out there.
It's a valid criticism of the general process of subjectivity here. It's not specifically evidence expectation. Because if you think this is what subjective probability means, suppose somebody asks what's my personal probability of British Prime Minister Tony Blair winning the next election. I suspect it's about 98%. Now, I don't in fact intend to put any money on the result one way or another. So insofar as this approach works because it's saying counterfactually, if I were to make that bet, what odds would I take on it? So if you think that sort of counterfactuals have no place, then that's fair enough. I don't think you see why. But if you don't, then to some extent observers on you, what's your alternative theory of probability to offer? I think that's a rhetorical question.
Remember, please keep an eye on the webpage for your recommended reading for next week's lectures on the Roy Bone. And I think we've got all the book made upon, so you can follow up after the lecture and take David to task for your counting arguments.
Well, I don't know the accounting, but
I'm going to say it loud.